Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 81, section 6. We got into this section a ways. It's on old single column page 908, and it's item number 6. In that great, big, huge, long list of large items. Hearken back to the beginning of section 6 and just remind yourself of what we're in the midst of. So the title of the section is The Maintenance of Civilization. And you can see that tiny little preface to the list. Let me just read that and remind you of what each of these items is hearkening back to. It said, the civilization which is now evolving on Urantia grew out of and is predicated on the following factors. So these are foundational elements, predicated on, very much in the sense that what follows stems from, that grew out of, it stems from these items. It's not like when you move away from these items, you can toss them out, as now you stand on some higher footings or something. Right, these have to be maintained, as it says there in the title. If any of these foundational elements is not tended to, there's going to be issues in trying to maintain the beginnings of a higher civilization that was dawning at the beginning of the 20th century. Now, of course, we know that if everything was okay with those foundational elements, we wouldn't even have the fifth epical revelation. Right. So, it's just a given as you're studying these that, at least some of them, if not all of them to some degree, are not being kept properly in mind and things are slipping. That's why the book is here. And it's fundamentally a civilizational emergency. So this is obviously extremely relevant to the immediacy of why the book is here. Just remember that when you go from mere society to society plus culture, it's just merely culture, to society plus culture all the way to civilization, any genuineness to civilization requires a significant, at least in the leadership, philosophic consciousness. Right? It's way too sophisticated a phenomenon to just happen naturally with the God-given context that we are all born into. There has to have been some taking delight in cultivating beyond those beginning levels, and that has to be maintained by the leadership, and everyone then functions within the scope of that framework that has been developed through reflective thinking. Okay, so that's why it's also a philosophic emergency, like I say all the time. I mean, the two go hand in hand, civilizational emergency, philosophic emergency. You can't have civilization without a philosophic context in individuals to begin with. Okay, so as when they say is now evolving on Urantia, see, that's those, at the beginning of the 20th century, that's referring to those 2,500 years of reflective thinking starting back in the 6th century BC, being as 6th century BC, going forward, allowing for this sophistication of association amongst individuals. Just it doesn't happen naturally without that reflective predicate. Okay, so let's get into them now. So here's another one of these elements that are foundational, and you know, it unlike the ones that we talked about in the prior part of this section, that this one might catch you off guard initially. It's like, whoa, language? Seriously? What's I don't get that one. So let's see what they have to say about language.
6, effectiveness of language. The spread of civilization must wait upon language. Live and growing languages ensure the expansion of civilized thinking and planning. During the early ages, important advancements were made in language. Today, there is great need for further linguistic development to facilitate the expression of evolving thought.
Okay, so what's between the lines there, most immediately, about why language is coming in here, is basically all of the sophistication that we have in language is the product of those philosophers, of that reflective thinking. That's who coined, you know, most of the significant words. Okay? Because, you know, these are words that are not just naming some object that, you know, Og can't help but trip over, right? Right, you know, it's not just table and chair and whatnot, okay? But, you know, abstract concepts and yes, all of those efforts to go beyond the immediate that reflective thinkers produced, you know, as you're reflecting, it's like, okay, I see there's this issue, or there's this idea, or there's this concept. I need a name for that. And so you coin a term, and the language gets more sophisticated. And then the whole civilization functions within that. You know, like law. To just come up with the concept of law, I mean, that's nothing that naturally you stumble over. Right? You know, and, you know, but eventually you get a people who say, you know, we're people of the law. See, that's people of an abstraction. Right? You're not people of that big granite rock over there that's really impressive, like those ancient people, you know, or something like that. Right, the volcano or whatever. Right, you know. So, see, that only came through reflective thinking. So, you know, when they say during the earlier ages, important advances were made by reflective thinkers. And then when they say today there is great need for further linguistic development, that's another way of saying it's sad to record that so few persons on Urantia take delight in cultivating. Yeah, it's the exact same fact. If there was significant reflective thinking, the language would be growing, because the humans would be growing, and language expresses that expansion, the expansion of that growth. Okay, so that's the key. See, personal living philosophy, live and growing languages. See, just all—it's all talking about those key things that I bring up all the time. That's the deal to appreciate, and that's why I'm constantly trying to highlight language issues with the Revelation. There's no way for you to get the truth of the fifth epical Revelation with the relationship to language that you have just naturally, especially now, right? If you'd been born in the 19th century, you know, some things would have gotten to you a little more naturally. I mean, we all know that, you know, just the penmanship of a cannon fodder soldier in the Civil War was magnificent, right? So, things have deteriorated a lot in the 20th century.
Yeah. I've always found it curious their use of words like nonetheless and heretofore. They're not words that we normally hear or use in our everyday language. Right. They might appear archaic, but they use them, and they have a definite purpose.
Yeah, and they're obviously, you know, you're just concatenating expressions from the way you had to precisely lay out words describing your reasoning. Nonetheless, right? You just stick it all together, nonetheless. It's all those things that hearken to reason and logic. Okay, let's see what else we have here.
Language evolved out of group associations, each local group developing its own system of word exchange. Language grew up through gestures, signs, cries, imitative sounds, intonation, and accent to the vocalization of subsequent alphabets. Language is man's greatest and most serviceable thinking tool, but it never flourished until social groups acquired some leisure. The tendency to play with language develops new words, slang. If the majority adopt the slang, then usage constitutes it language. The origin of dialects is illustrated by the indulgence in baby talk in a family group.
Just the last little thing. I mean, it's just a very trivial example of baby talk. But the point is not, you know, baby talk, but just how instinctually everyone will synchronize a mode of speech, you know, to sort of embrace the group fact of the group, right? You just all strike step with, you know, and so maybe the king initiates it, you know, the way the king talks, and everyone just talks the same way, and, you know, and a dialect develops. That, you know, that's the idea of that group, that natural group identification phenomenon. The thing in the middle there, see, it never flourished until social groups acquired some leisure. Because until there's leisure, there's no reflective thinking. Again, see. All right, let's see. I mean, the rest of it, I think, is pretty straightforward. But, you know, you notice that even though it's straightforward, they're laying it out because they aren't just going to tell you kind of these basic things about language. They're wanting you to get to kind of think about the science of it a little bit, you know, not just the philosophy of it, but, you know, so you appreciate the some of the how of the evolution of language. So it's just emphasizing how important it is that humans appreciate some of the details. You actually have to get into those details some to properly engage the revelation. I mean, how many times do I bring up etymology? That's a science. Okay? That's why they're giving you all that detail. They're trying to foster. You need to have some precision. You have to constantly, you know, think, oh, now what is the literal meaning of that word? You suppose the revelators are playing off the literal meaning. I should go look it up, figure it out. And to do that, you caveat emptor. I mean, there's true and false etymologies out there, just like there's true and false science of any flavor. Right? You have to be discriminating. But nonetheless, you know, you have to get into that process to begin to appreciate what it is that they're trying to foster the recognition of, you know, that goes beyond the words, you know, and you can't get to what goes beyond the words until you get a precise relationship to the words. Like I've emphasized recently, in order to get up to the religious consciousness on the sixth level of meaning, you have to go through scientific consciousness on the fourth level of meaning. In other words, you have to fire up your first cosmic intuition a little bit, be able to bring your mind to a sharp point focus. Well, you have to be able to think precisely. You can't find the real God with a fuzzed out mind. You know, an obvious prerequisite to God knowingness on the sixth level is the prerequisite precision of mind. I mean, and it's like, well, I don't understand that. Well, think of one simple thing. You know, it's described as a still small voice that you're looking for. Small. So if you're fuzzed out and can't bring your mind to a point, can you find a small thing? No. Right? You have to be able to bring your mind to a sharp, precise focus in order to find the real God. In that fuzzed out state, all you'll find is some notion that you've brought in from the external world. Right? Your neighbors or your ancestors or whatever. So that's, again, it's very, very important element here. So that's the key thing that's going on here. All right, keep going.
Language differences have been the great barrier to the extension of peace. The conquest of dialects must precede the spread of a culture throughout a race, over a continent, or to a whole world. A universal language promotes peace, ensures culture, and augments happiness. Even when the tongues of a world are reduced to a few, the mastery of these by the leading cultural peoples mightily influences the achievement of worldwide peace and prosperity.
Okay, so obviously, you know, you're very helpful in bridging the natural divides that separate us. I mean, you know, if only you could talk to that person, you might discover, wow, we actually think a lot alike, and you know, and immediately you could be, you know, best friends. But you don't have any idea what the heck they're saying, so you just keep walking. You know, so there's that obvious immediate element, but they're also bringing in, notice that list there. Okay, promotes peace. You know, that like I said, that seems fairly straightforward to appreciate that if you can talk to one another, maybe less likely to get upset. Ensures culture, you know, so that you know, it's the culture is just embedded in the language to a large degree, and so it kind of, you can fall back and rest on that that insurance policy, you know, as it were, of the language that's just there. But the augments happiness one might strike you as curious. If you're thinking properly about the word happiness, of course, you know, if you think it's just warm fuzziness, you know, you think it's, well, that's just like the promotes peace thing. It's like, no, you know, happiness, that's where there's some sort of difficulty that you're not responding naturally to. You know, the very you know, pleasurable satisfaction that you get in having risen above that difficulty, you know, and found an inner peace with it. Okay, so how does that work? Well, see, you know, augments happiness. You know, you can add bricks of happiness, to, you know, to your experiential nature. Well, how, if I'm going to do that, that means I've got to have to have access to more and more divides that aren't naturally bridged, and I have to bridge them. Well, if I have a common language, then I have access to all kinds of other people that are way different than me. And I can have the happiness of finding a way to transcend that divide between all those different people and possess the resulting happiness. It doesn't happen automatically. You gotta work for that happiness. But that's what the deal is with that happiness. It's all the additional different people that you are then challenged to form a relationship with. Because now you potentially can, because you can speak the same language.
That's why it's so important to assimilate in a country like America, where you have the hodgepodge of everybody.
Right, if you want that super summative consequence of all those different people, you have to have a common language.
Then yeah. You understand each place where they come from. You understand the people because you can communicate with them.
Yeah, and if you don't have that common language, they just pool into like languages, and you've short-circuited all that super summative potential of the differences amongst those two pools of people. Yeah. Okay.
While Very little progress has been made on Urantia towards developing an international language. Much has been accomplished by the establishment of international commercial exchange. And all these international relations should be fostered, whether they involve language, trade, art, science, competitive play, or religion.
They know how long-term some of these things that, you know, bordering on light and life are on this planet. You know, so recognize what you can do in the meantime. You know, and of course, we all know the internet is just innately fostering an expansion of the use of English. Now, you know, there's all kinds of other languages on the internet too, but it fits in with the, you know, the international commercial exchange thing. It just, you know, the more we go with these phenomena, these kind of globalized phenomena, the more it will just naturally, it's like, you know, this would all just be a lot easier if we didn't have, you know, 600 different languages on the internet, and, you know, or 600 different languages in, you know, in our trade talks or whatever. It's just, you know, it gets so tedious, you know, and to talk to someone and you have to have translators on both ends, and, you know, so you just naturally start to, it's like, you know, I'm going to be working with the French an awful lot, you know, as a businessman. I'm going to learn French, right? It just makes it so much easier. Now, of course, a lot of the Europeans have kind of already taken the step, and, you know, they're at least bilingual. They know English and their native language. Anyway, so that, you know, and remember how we, you know, when they touched upon the significance of international trade organizations relative to visionary peace planning. Anyway, so here it is again, you know, about the international commercial exchange.
In Ghana, where my daughter lives, there are numerous dialects or tribal languages, but the national language, the language of the state, is English.
Yeah, and of course, the colonization of Africa, so, you know, injected these, you know, national languages into all those tribes. They're still quite tribal, but, you know, they can all speak French, or they can all speak English, or, you know, or whatever. Yeah. Okay, let's keep going here.
7, effectiveness of mechanical devices. The progress of civilization is directly related to the development and possession of tools, machines, and channels of distribution. Improved tools, ingenious and efficient machines, determine the survival of contending groups in the arena of advancing civilization.
Okay, so everything was probably, you know, you're probably thinking, okay, I'm kind of getting this, but see the little zinger at the end there, right? We all know that the Chinese know that final fact, right? You know? And, that determines the survival of contending groups in the arena of advancing civilization. They know that. You know, so they're trying to get that technological advantage. And, you know, in a survival of the fittest, you know, modality. Okay, so we have to keep that in mind. You can't have, you know, illusions about that. That's a cold, hard evolutionary fact. When they would use the word survival, that should get your attention. Okay?
In the early days, the only energy applied to land cultivation was manpower. It was a long struggle to substitute oxen for men, since this threw men out of employment. Latterly, machines have begun to displace men, and every such advance is directly contributory to the progress of society because it liberates manpower for the accomplishment of more valuable tasks.
So there again, you kind of see, you know, when they brought up leisure before, you know, there's that's always in play in a lot of these elements, you know, so that you can have time for at least, you know, a subset of your population to be thinking reflectively. You know, remember how they make that very stark comment about how important slavery was right, to begin with in that way. And one of the reasons slavery is indispensable in the early days, so that at least someone has a little leisure time can begin to reflect and think beyond just the immediacies of why you have slaves so that everyone doesn't starve to death, right? You know, to get beyond the nutrition epic.
Yeah, and think about when, you know, in the early 1900s when the washing machine wasn't, you know, they had the kind that you would crank and
right.
You'd have to
wringer washers and,
and you'd have to go hang up the clothes on a line or they wouldn't dry. So now you just toss them in. It doesn't take any of that effort anymore. So everybody's been released from the home chores, basically, you know, that you would burden people.
Yeah, and of course, you know, the challenge is, since it's not really easy to wash clothes, do people, you know, turn the washing machine into, you know, a new enemy, you know, instead of washing clothes once a week because it was just so much work. Now you wash clothes every day. It's like, are you really saving time? See, there's always that downside to technology. You know, as I joke often, making machines do more so man can do less. Because we end up just becoming enslaved to them in various ways. You know, and they don't actually liberate us to do something else. They become our masters. So, yeah, there's a difficult adolescent transition thing with technology to get to the point where you're not being ruled by the machines. But nonetheless, the point, you know, it has to be there so that eventually there can be enough leisure time for reflective expansion of civilization.
Reflective thinking is a choice.
Yes.
If you don't have leisure, you can't make a choice.
Right.
You can make a bad choice and not reflect, but at least you have the opportunity.
Yeah, right.
Science guided by wisdom may become man's great social liberator. A mechanical age can prove disastrous only to a nation whose intellectual level is too low to discover those wise methods and sound techniques for successfully adjusting to the transition difficulties arising from the sudden loss of employment by large numbers consequent upon the too rapid invention of new types of labor-saving machinery.
Right, so whenever we have this issue and everyone starts howling, you know, the robots are replacing us, you know, they're reminding you. It's like, well, maybe the big problem here is not the robots. Maybe it's the lowliness of your intellectual level. Ouch. All right. The more sophisticated machinery gets, the more mere human inventiveness is not going to be up to it. You're going to have to actually bring in some genuine creativity. Right? You're going to have to get up to genuinely human intellectual levels where there's creativity and you're not just dependent upon the really fancy animal who is very inventive or something, you know, that pops up every once in a while. You're going to have to get very sophisticated in your thinking about how to manage all this. Very complex problem.
8, character of torchbearers. Social inheritance enables man to stand on the shoulders of all who have preceded him and who have contributed aught to the sum of culture and knowledge. In this work of passing on the cultural torch to the next generation, the home will ever be the basic institution. The play and social life comes next, with the school last but equally indispensable in a complex and highly organized society.
Okay, that's another very precise thing where they give you all 3 of those elements. As we see all the time, the home, the family, is the foundational institution of all human institutions. So again, that's being held up. But then, you know, you expand out from there. You know, like the next one, the play and social life, you know, it's if you're a parent, you go, well, I'm trying to influence my child, but then there's the neighbor kid that my child plays with and he's starting to copy everything. Yeah, right. It expands out. And then they go to school and then all those influences come in. Right, so it's just that natural expansion out. And, you know, they're pointing out that even though you kind of initially experience this in a negative mode, it's like, oh my goodness, my child just brought home from school today. They have all these new words in their vocabulary or whatever, right? But there is a positive place for all those, and you need to, even though it gets more and more difficult the farther from the family nucleus it goes, that all has to have greater and greater integrity as you go forward, or it's not going to go forward. And we all know how many times I bring up how schools have gotten so unfortunate, right, in their quality, and we all know how many of these things and families are falling apart, and those issues are very obvious.
That's because you have low-level people teaching.
Right, again,
and they
it's
don't
like,
stick to a curriculum.
But see that
their own curriculum.
Right, and that's of course the thing. See, right? I mean, because once it gets started, I mean, once you no longer have an institution with quality teachers, well, then where do quality teachers ever come from again? Because low-quality teachers produce low-quality students who grow up to be the next teachers, and you know, see, that's the thing. I mean, it took a million years to get the first teachers for Oxford University, right? The first university.
Hmm.
If you throw away those quality teachers and all the institutions are populated by pitiful professors, does that mean it's going to take another million years to get that back again?
I hope not.
See, that took a long time. That's one of those classic, you know, if salt loses its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? And it's very, you know, as a head scratcher, I figured out, it's like, oh, how is that going to work? Because it's just a negative, you set up a negative feedback thing. And it just, it's hard to break out of.
Insects are born fully educated and equipped for life. Indeed, a very narrow and purely instinctive existence. The human baby is born without an education, therefore man possesses the power, by controlling the educational training of the younger generation, greatly to modify the evolutionary course of civilization. I should have waited for that.
You know it's always coming up.
Yes, yeah, there it is. Right, and seeing, of course, those who have radical goals, right, know this, right, and that's why they'll work patiently for years to corrupt all the institutions, right, because that's part of the whole plan, right? You can control how it goes forward. Once you take control of all the teachers, you have control of all the students, and you have control of the future. And wherewith shall it be salted? Yeah, it's very, very problematic. And see, don't think that we stumbled into this state. Yes, in some cases it's unwitting and ignorant, but it all got initiated in very purposeful fashion. Right? You have to sever your relationship to the founding fathers. You have to sever your relationship to religion. You have to sever your relationship to any sort of philosophic education. And all those are key elements in order to disrupt it all and remake it in your malignant image.
Boy, they knew when they wrote this book that we were going to come this
yes.
paragraph and say, wow.
Yeah. Now,
jeez.
Just a little aside, I often bring up this paragraph because, see, you're in the midst of talking about civilization. You have a very direct statement about what adjuvants an insect has. Did you notice that? See, indeed, a very narrow and purely instinctive existence. Right? Which adjuvant is the energy of instinct? Number one. See? And there it is, right between the lines. You know, if you want to say, well, I wonder if insects just have the first, or maybe that, see, there it is. They just have the first adjuvant. That's all an insect has.
That's good, so we squash it.
But we all know, right, that purely instinctive thing can be quite complex and fancy because, of course, it's not their mind, really. It's her mind. It's the Creative Mother Spirit's mind. So insects can do very fancy things purely instinctually, but nonetheless, see, it's just, you know.
Even so-called social insects.
Yes, even so-called social. Because remember, the adjutants have an individual mode and a collective mode. And you know, remember when we went through over-control of evolution, we saw where they were talking about the adjutants, you know, in that case the first adjutant going from the individual mode to the collective mode, where you have single-celled organisms functioning in colonies, right? And you can still take, you know, one cell out of that colony and it's fine by itself because it's a full organism itself, but they're functioning together in colonies because the first adjutant is not only engaging each individual single-celled animal individually, but engaging in its collective mode, coordinating them in a colony. Yeah. But eventually, of course, you get specialization of cells. Right? I mean, I can't take a skin cell out of me and it functions as a separate me, a mini-me. No, see, it's not like that. I'm not a colony of single-celled organisms. Right? I have specialized cells. And each of them is dependent upon all the others in their specialization. Oh, and that's coming up soon here in the list. So that's the, if you ever, it's like, where is that spot where it mentions about the first adjutant with insects? There it is, item number 8, and yeah, here in the, about civilization. Okay.
The greatest 20th century influences contributing to the furtherance of civilization and the advancement of culture are the marked increase in world travel and the unparalleled improvements in methods of communication. But the improvement in education has not kept pace with the expanding social structure. Neither has the the modern appreciation of ethics developed in correspondence with growth along more purely intellectual and scientific lines. And modern civilization is at a standstill in spiritual development in the safeguarding of the home institution.
So there's one, you know, that should remind you of stuff you hear me say all the time, plus dispel certain illusions you might have. So first of all, you know, we all know, and you kind of see the way they're talking about it, how unparalleled improvements in methods of communication, you know, travel and stuff. I mean, you, just the way they're saying it, it's as if they already know the whole of the 20th century and are talking about it, you know. Like we were talking last week, right? I mean, they know, you know, what the basics of the entire 20th century were going to be, you know, writing at the beginning. You know, so it doesn't say the greatest, early 20th century influences. See, they just say the greatest 20th century influences, right? Okay, all right. They know how it's all going to play out. See, when you throw in... you know, there you have education, of course. We were already talking about that. But then, you know, neither has the modern appreciation of ethics developed. Well, why not? Well, because ethics isn't a science. Ethics is a discipline of philosophy. Right? And you basically threw philosophy out at the beginning of the 20th century. So, of course, that's going to wane. Right, ethics is just going to descend back into natural evolutionary mori systems and their, you know, arbitrariness and inefficiency. You know, takes thousands and thousands of years of trial and error, and eventually you have a, you know, mori system that kind of sort of works. But, you know, thousands, if not millions, of people had to die and whatnot, and, you know, to figure it out, and it's a very inefficient method of improving, you know, interpersonal associations, the quality of them. Anyway, you know, reflective thinking can learn by looking instead of having to learn by leaping. See, that's what ethics is about. It requires reflective thinking. See, purely intellectual and scientific lines. You know, we all know how much it got off on that track and then just became intellectual and technological lines now. But then the one that should, you know, challenge you a little bit, and modern civilization is at a standstill in spiritual development. Mm-hmm. And you go, no, man, the 20th century has gotten more and more spiritual all the time. Okay, well, in some like, you know, doesn't Chris always say the dawning of the sixth adjutant, you know, in the collective in the middle of the 20th century? And, right, that's a unity consciousness adjutant. Okay. You go, oh, they must be talking about something more significant than just my energization, right? They must be speaking about my holistic spiritual consciousness, like the Holy Spirit. They must be talking about the upper domain, not the sixth adjutant, the lower domain, the spiritualized mind in the upper domain. They must be talking about, oh, it's the sad to record thing again. Right? So that challenge I'm always putting out there. So you think you're spiritual. Don't be so quickly satisfied with your spirituality. Mankind hasn't even begun to explore. So, you know, always be looking for something of higher quality, something more truthful, something more holistic. And then, like I mentioned a little bit ago, we all know how we're doing with safeguarding the home institution. right. So, and just, you know, when all is said and done, you know, come back to that religious element there. You know, why it's in that list. Because it's impossible for me to have a genuine philosophic consciousness if I don't have the nucleus of that philosophic consciousness, a genuine religious consciousness. You know, you always can come back to, you know, that the philosophic emergency, you know, has a nucleus issue to it. I mean, you can't have any genuineness to your philosophy if all you have is mere evolutionary religious notions. You need to have some genuine religious consciousness to get anywhere. I mean, so it's, you know, when you think about this issue of a philosophic emergency, remember how, you know, what you're given by grace with your encirclement of the Holy Spirit. You're given initial superconsciously, you're given a religious nucleus and a philosophic sphere surrounding it up there. Okay? So, you know, the beginning of the emergency is letting go of that, what you have by grace. But the real issue is not merely that you've let go of the nucleus point, right? It's the problems of civilization can't be solved merely by genuine religious consciousness. Right? You need the philosophic sphere around that. So, you know, and on one hand, you could say there's a religious emergency, but you know, you got to be careful, see, because that can take you off on a false tangent. You know, it is fundamentally a philosophic emergency, but every philosophic emergency has a religious nucleus issue. Okay, and so that's why there's a lot about religion in the book. Which, if that's the only thing that your eye is attuned to, you could scan through the book and think this is a religious text. No, it's a philosophic text. It talks about more than just the nucleus of the sphere. And it talks about the whole sphere.
We're not going to solve our problems with a humanistic philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's see. Where were we here? Make sure I've gotten everything.
That unparalleled improvements in methods of communication.
Oh.
I mean, when they started doing this book, we were on the telegraph, weren't we?
Yeah, like I said, again, it doesn't say early 20th century there. They know exactly how the internet's going to develop and all that way back at the beginning. Okay, they know exactly how it's all going to play out. Right, so that's, like I said last time, you know, there's so many places you can read in the book. You're going, wait a minute, I just forgot that this was written clear back at the beginning of the 20th century. It's not written like it was clear back at the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, occasionally, you know, when it says 48 states, say, okay, it reminds you very directly, oh, it was before there were 50 states. Okay, but so many times, right, it's like it was written today.
They couldn't have really, back then, though, they couldn't have said 50 states because then the people in the now would have said, what did they mean, 50 states?
Right, but of course, you know, they knew full well, you know, to, like I always say, to 10 decimal places, you know, that there would be two more states and exactly when they would be brought into the, I mean, because most of our lives could be calculated in advance, right? I mean, so, you know, they knew. They could have said, and you will have 50 states soon. You know, they could have said that. Okay, let's keep going.
9, the racial ideals. The ideals of one generation carve out the channels of destiny for immediate posterity. The quality of the social torchbearers will determine whether civilization goes forward or backward. The homes, churches, and schools of one generation predetermine the character trend of the succeeding generation. The moral and spiritual momentum of a race or a nation largely determines the cultural velocity of that civilization.
Okay, so we kind of already sort of talked about some of that and talking about education, and I was sort of laying out the these grand plans that these radicals have had for so long. You know, when they say the homes, churches, and schools of one generation predetermine the character trend of the succeeding generation, you know, and if what you want the future to be is anarchy and chaos, well, then you just totally blow up the homes, churches, and schools, and right, then that's what you get. From that nothing, you get the nothing, the nihilism that you want, right, is an end. But notice the little important use of language there. It probably caught you. You know, they start the moral and spiritual momentum on the one hand, but the cultural velocity, the other. It's like, Okay, you know, remember that momentum is mass times velocity? So there's two components to that one. All right, so think about that. What are they getting at? Moral and spiritual, those individuals possess that. Right? Ethics is a group thing. Morality is an individual fact, and spiritual too. So you're talking about individuals there possessing something. So you not only have the velocity of an individual morally, but you've got the number of individuals. Right, and you know, so you could have a lot of individuals with a little velocity, or a few individuals with a large velocity. Either way, you're going to have the same momentum, and a momentum that you need, and that leads to the velocity of the whole collective. Like they're saying, so just you know, don't just scrunch your face when you come across something like that. Pause and figure out why did they mix up the words like that. What are they getting at? They want you to think about it. Because we all have a false concept of morality and spirituality as being something that is, you know, we're all bathing in or something. No, it's all, you know, inside of you, literally way inside of you. It's all in the upper domain. You know, your genuine inner life is the only place where there's morality and spirituality, really. Okay, everything else in the lower domain and out in the external world is a shadow cast outward, right? An outward expression from that source of individual nature, individual human nature.
Could also that velocity mean where it's going? Like if it's going forward or backward, it could go either way.
Yeah, sure. They didn't just say speed; they said velocity because it allows you to think about direction and not just magnitude. Yeah, 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 that works too. But anyway, that's the so they're bringing out ideals, and you know they're going to flesh this out a little bit more. But just remember again, ideals are tied to spirit stuff and ideas. When you translate, when you're inspired by those spiritual ideals, you express down and out in relationship to things, material things, with specific ideas, inspired, motivated by those internal ideals. Okay, so they're going to play that out. And again, so many people think that ideals is something about the objects, the things and beings out there in the external world. And there's idyllic arrangements of things and beings. No, that's material idealism. That's not true idealism. Idealism is spiritual only. The moment that you do that, you're turning yourself inside out. And you're going to get very frustrated trying to satisfy your relationship to ideals by rearranging the molecules in the external world. Okay? For one thing, you're not sovereign out there. Someone's always, some vast conspiracy is always going to thwart you. The only place you can realize this relationship to ideals is in the inner domain, the deep inner domain where you're sovereign. Instead of frustration, you'll eventuate happiness if you don't turn yourself inside out. Okay, so that's what they want. They want to talk about the ideals and how that, So again, see, we're talking about an individual fact that's going to manifest outward as with societal consequences. Okay, what do they say here?
Ideals elevate the source of the social stream. And no stream will rise any higher than its source, no matter what technique of pressure or directional control may be employed. The driving power of even the most material aspects of a cultural civilization is resident in the least material of society's achievements. Intelligence may control the mechanism of civilization. Wisdom may direct it. But spiritual idealism is the energy which really uplifts and advances human culture from one level of attainment to another.
All right. So spiritual idealism, that only exists in the inner life of individuals. And that's the source. And when they give that analogy about, pressure and directional control with the stream and all that, you're going, well, okay, what are they getting at? They explain, intelligence may control the mechanism of civilization. And so that's analogizes the pressure there. And then obviously the directional control, well, that's wisdom may direct it. And so, there's intelligence and wisdom, but, you're not going to somehow progress mankind to the era of light and life, those high elevations, through ever more sophisticated iPhones or something, right? Or an ever broader bandwidth internet or something, right? Technology will never be our civilizational savior. So they're again pointing out the importance of these issues of the individual, like I was saying. And remember when we were talking about civilization, as we went from clan to tribe to nation to territorial state. The key thing when you went from got all the way to a territorial state is now you have citizens. That concept of citizens. So again, that's not natural. Reflective thinking produces that concept. And without reflective thinking, people go, well, I don't know, citizens, what's the point of that? And everyone falls back, and rejects the concept of citizens. But that's a key step. Because the heights of civilization, like you're pointing out, are predicated on ever more profound individuals, ever more personal individuals, and personalities absolutely unique, right? It can't express in some horde, you know, some amorphous collective, right? It requires individual citizens. So that's how you can, you know, appreciate how the general nature of the societal organization is related to what they're talking about here. And it's, you know, you're not trying to just have the society of a clan, you know, level of development. You're trying to have territorial states with citizens, and that requires quality thinking, the quality of social torchbearers. Notice how they're building, you know, they bring up torchbearers, and then they build upon that in the next one. They've got a whole sequence going here. Okay.
Quality italicized.
Yeah, quality's italicized there, yeah. You'll see what they were leading up to here in the next little paragraph.
What about that? The stream, and no stream will rise any higher than its source, no matter what technique of pressure or directional control may be employed. Well, right now, I mean, look at, you know, the ideals that are out there,
mm-hmm.
and we've got our certain ideals here and then other ideals here, you know, and...
And, of course, are they really ideals at all, or are they just, I like this material arrangement. Well, I like this material arrangement. See, and again, so if you think about it, you know, of spirit over mind over matter, right, various material so-called ideals, right, in the plane, you know, what kind of a velocity is there going to be in the stream if there are no mountains that it's flowing down from, if it originates on the plane, right? And will it be charting a course somewhere definitively? No, it'll be meandering all over the place, and right. Yeah. So the pressure, you know, it doesn't matter if you stick in a Venturi tube or something or whatever, right? I mean, the stream is, you know, it's never going to go up above, if you put it in a U shape, it's not going to rise higher than what it started out with. Right? So, you know, and just to recognize that it's up to the individuals, right? All these ideas that we can externalize this, and there we can just have a government, an impersonal government with a centralized control that will be the source point. No. It has to be individuals, right? And the more that the poor man's unity reigns supreme, that desire for uniformity, right? The more that the individuals are washed away, the less spiritual everything is, the lower the source of all the streams becomes. That's what they're talking about.
Okay. At first,
yep. Hold on 1 second. There's a question over here. Yep.
I'm just trying to understand what spiritual idealism,
mm-hmm.
I hear you saying is that it's essentially individual.
Mm-hmm.
But it can't be. Is there no collective phenomenon? There has to be a collective phenomenon.
Right, I mean.
But without the individual.
Yeah, I mean, society has something predicated on what the individuals are.
Right. Can't be more than the individual.
Right. I mean, if you are spiritual, automatically, there are fruits of the Spirit. Right? But the Spirit doesn't somehow come out of your mouth and start flowing in rivers out there. Right? It stays inside. Right? This is all matter out there. The fruits of the Spirit are material. You know, in the sense that those material facts are coordinated in a way that doesn't happen naturally. They're coordinated in a way directed towards the fulfillment of the spiritual ideals that are recognized inside the individuals involved. Right? If we coordinate ourselves this way, we function in a way that is more like the ideal that I recognize inside. But I know that it'll never be exactly the ideal. If for no other reason, everyone takes a notch up, and now the ideals are higher, and it needs to be rearranged out here again to match the higher recognition of ideals, but it's still not quite. But then you go up, you know, and it's just never ending. Right? The ideas will never, you know, be equivalent to the ideals.
Even in eternity.
Even in eternity, yeah. You know, so, I mean, see, this quest for ideals is driving everything, like they're saying, see? Okay, let's get that last little nugget there.
At first, life was a struggle for existence. Now, for a standard of living. Next, it will be for a quality of thinking, the coming earthly goal of human existence.
Okay, so here, you know, so you start with the struggle for existence, then you start with a struggle for a standard of living, then you start with a, then you go to a struggle for quality of thinking. See, in this mode, they want to remind you that the effort, struggle, conflict, you know, process is always in play. You don't want to overplay the parallel of effort, struggle, conflict, etc. with the developmental epics. You don't want to overplay that. You know, like remember how we were talking about, you finally get to the material comfort area, and okay, now you start to get the conflict. That the effort and struggle of the nutrition epic and the security age, you know, led you to. You know, well, don't overplay that. I mean, there's effort, struggle, conflict, you know, in every stage. And they're just reminding you here. You know, initially you're struggling relative to, you know, fear and hunger with the nutrition epic and the security age. Okay, and then you get to the material comfort era. Okay, now you're struggling for a standard of living. Oh, and we all know what comes next, the quest for knowledge and wisdom, right? That's next will be for quality of thinking, the quest for knowledge and wisdom. You know, and it's not just quantity of thinking, because it isn't wisdom and knowledge, it's knowledge and wisdom. Wisdom's the foundation. And, you can't get that without full-on quality. So, you know, that's what that's referring to.
Control and direct.
Mm-hmm.
Same little parallel.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, everyone remembers that famous little passage there. And I just, you know, I hope you have an ever-growing appreciation of what it's referring to. You know, your initial thought when you probably first found this book, oh, so many years ago, was some sort of, you know, quality of thinking, oh, that's, everyone will be really spiritual. obviously, that's not quite, right? Especially in the initial thinking of what the word spiritual meant. Okay. But what it's talking about is philosophic minds. You know, you can just imagine how long it would be before there's just a few such minds. You know, because if we don't get some sort of additional help, right, we've got to do with evolution what Revelation would have done. I mean, the magisterial son's job, you know, would have been to get this sort of quality going. Mm-hmm. We didn't get a magisterial son.
So okay. The quality of thinking is only coming from wisdom. And if there's no quality of thinking, there will be no wisdom, unless it's some kind of a dire plan out here to make it.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so many things that are thwarting wisdom, right? I mean, like you're saying, I mean, for number one, it's sad to record. Okay, you know, remember, you have tribulation, you have a problematic experience. Well, if you haven't developed, you know, using your insight to, you know, reflect back upon that troubling experience, right? If insight's not in play, I mean, wisdom can't result. Wisdom is the super additive consequence of the relationship between your insight into that past event and the difficulties of that past event. So the sad to record thing is short-circuiting wisdom. You know, and then, of course, the material comfort era, a lot of that is, I need to arrange my life so there's never any tribulation. Well, that short-circuits it too, see? You might have insight, but there's no tribulation, right? So either way, the super additive consequence doesn't happen.
But what is it that people are so stupid right now? I mean, you know, they're looking before you, leaping before you look.
Yeah, right.
Can't they see where things are heading? Why would they, you know, I mean, there's no wisdom at all in our society, it seems, except for a few. Mm-hmm. It's very scary.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, like we pointed out, I mean, you know, we can hold up some revolutionary, you know, little nugget of wisdom somewhere in the book and say, boy, if only, you know, the world could just, you know, get that little bit. But then you can remind yourself, except they're quoting Proverbs there, which we actually got thousands and thousands of years ago. Oops. Yeah, see. And this is a fault of education, right? And it starts with the family. I mean, the family is, you know, is initially foundationally seeing to the passing along of the fruits of the past to the next generation. We aren't doing that anymore. Right? I mean, you know, there was a time when the most revered person in the tribe was the wise old man, right? If you're an old male, you're demonized.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. If you have any signs of andite consciousness, you know, that just adds to your demonization. Some kind of person with a future time orientation. It's an abomination.
Why is
this
guy
used to live? Oh, he's
hiding.
Yes. They all went underground, you know, to save their heads. Okay, so, but you know, on the positive side, remember, the book isn't all negative, right? I mean, if it was hopeless, the book wouldn't be here, right? We are quivering on the very brink of moving to the quest for knowledge and wisdom, or at least it was a very brink at the beginning of the 20th century. It's less very all the time, right? Right? But, you know, we could go forward into the next developmental epoch, or we could fall back.
It's going fast, whichever way it's going.
Right, yeah, and it'll go, the more we go forward, the faster it'll go one way or the other. Yeah.
Okay, 10, coordination of specialists. Civilization has been enormously advanced by the early division of labor and by its later corollary of specialization. Civilization is now dependent on the effective coordination of specialists. As society expands, some method of drawing together the various specialists must be found.
Okay, I mean, on one hand, that's very straightforward, but remember, they're stressing, don't forget about how foundational this fact is. And the easiest way to remember how foundational it is to think about your own body. Like I was alluding to, I told you we'd get to specialization in a second. All right, my body is a collection of specialized cells. All right, the skin cell just does those skin cell things. It doesn't do, it can't, you know, it isn't an interchangeable part with a brain cell or whatever. Okay, and the amount of mindal coordination that has to be present, ever present, to keep all this highly specialized, you know, in all these highly specialized individuals going as an organism, right? That's, you know, your body is a great example. I mean, you know, think about, you know, there's, you know, if you have, say, a trillion cells in your body and you have a trillion people on the planet, okay, you see, it's a similar system in complexity. So, yeah, you're pointing out, if you're going to go forward to anything fancy, you not only have to be in an analytic mode relative to the parts, but you have to be in a synthetic mode relative to the whole. Right? Coordination of specialists, that requires synthetic thinking, not merely analytic thinking. And we've been demonizing synthetic thinking for over 100 years now. I mean, that's the foundation of philosophy. Analytic thinking, that's science. Synthetic thinking is philosophy. Logic is synthetic. Okay, so, being able to have, to think in a holistic way about it and not just the dot to dot with the parts. Right? We're maxing out our analysis of the body, right? And we're, until we have a, start with the initial assumption that before the body's a bunch of parts, it's a system. And the only way you're going to understand it is in a logic mode rather than in a reason mode. Right? You're not going to get very far with medicine. Because a lot about the body is not to be figured out with analysis. Okay? It's not a scientific fact, see, merely. Okay? So anyway, all these things are together. But that's, just how much philosophy there has to be. As you go to these higher and higher elements in here, it's fundamentally that the mode of your mind when you're reflecting, and it's in that synthetic, that holistic mode. Okay?
Social, artistic, technical, and industrial specialists will continue to multiply and increase in skill and dexterity. In this diversification of ability and dissimilarity of employment, will eventually weaken and disintegrate human society if effective means of coordination and cooperation are not developed. But the intelligence which is capable of such inventiveness and such specialization should be wholly competent to devise adequate methods of control and adjustment for all problems resulting from the rapid growth of invention and the accelerated pace of cultural expansion.
Right, it should be. But again, it's not natural. You have to take delight in cultivating. Right? It's a very unnatural thing to use that synthetic mode of your mind in any conscious way. You just, it's there superconsciously, and you rest on that unwittingly, to get through your day-to-day life. But they're just pointing out, if you have that level of sophistication of mind analytically, there is a potential for a matching measure of big picture thinking. But you have to choose to bring that into play. It isn't so immediate as the linear stuff. Okay.
It's almost like we have to find some new techniques, because you look at even like the president, there's always been a respect that's just been there from citizens,
mm-hmm,
that is no longer there.
You're thinking about what's coming up. See? That's actually a point that they're going to bring up. See,
okay.
You're already thinking about how that logically leads to,
to the thing that you were talking about earlier in the earlier section. Okay, we are on this transition, and we know a lot about that. We're going to the quest of knowledge and wisdom, and then as an artist, I think about, I want to have this kindred mind. I want to find something that transcends whatever the difference is. Whether it's a whole civilization, America, looking at a president, and then on an individual level, how? So we they gave us all they have given us the things.
Well, see, I mean, just you know the you know,
to do it.
You know, think of a key thing you're bringing out there that you're struggling with. Okay, I mean, this natural tendency of the specialization of being an artist focuses you, you know, more and more, you know, like into an isolated mode even. See, that's what they're talking about here in number 10. I mean, it's not that that shouldn't happen. It needs to happen. I mean, specialists need to burrow in, you know, ever deeper, but that means the more they burrow into the depths of potential in their specialization, which needs to happen, the more you need someone whose job it is to coordinate these elements. You know, the deeper the artist goes, the less the artist can be the artist and the coordinator. And the artist starts to become more and more frustrated. It's important, see, that's what they're trying to get at. The farther you go along, the more there must be people whose job it is to not burrow down into a specialization, but see to the coordination. I mean, you know, this is recognized in engineering. You have the engineering specialist, and then there's a system engineer, see, that coordinates all of those individual specialists.
That's why orchestras have conductors.
And orchestras have conductors and, you know, various things, right? Yeah, so... Right, they're just pointing that out.
With a whole new way to do that.
Yeah.
And it is really teetering on the inner life, the development of the inner life. And that's how we're going to be able to transcend whatever our divots are in our genetics or our differences are. We're going to have something that unifies us that's so much more transcendent than the trivialities that divide us.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
again, it's just, you know, that's why it's sad to record, right? There's so few persons. I see that's, you're just getting at, see, it all comes back to that. Yeah. I mean, we can have all kinds of grand desires for wonderful futures, but if individuals aren't taking up an individual challenge, or if you think of them, one of these days Michael's going to return, and then so I don't have to take up an individual challenge. No, it doesn't matter if Michael comes. There's not going to be any light in life, you know, way down the road until individuals take up the challenge. No being is going to come from on high and magically give you an advanced personal living philosophy in your inner life. They can't. You're sovereign there. Only you can do anything with that domain. The Universal Father is completely impotent to do anything in the heart of your mind. He can do absolutely nothing there. The adjuster can be put in there, but that adjuster is always subservient to your will.
Imprisoned.
Yes. All right. So, I mean, there has to be this challenge of individuals, or nothing can happen. Okay, let's see, where were we here?
Number 11.
We were at 11. Let me make sure, did we get everything there? Let's see. Yeah, we got it all there. Okay, keep going.
Okay, 11, place-finding devices. The next age of social development will be embodied in a better and more effective cooperation and coordination of ever-increasing and expanding specialization. And as labor more and more diversifies, some technique for directing individuals to suitable employment must be devised. Machinery is not the only cause for unemployment among the civilized peoples of Urantia. Economic complexity and the steady increase of industrial and professional specialism add to the problems of labor placement.
See, like I said, they're just each one of these, you know, just rolls into the next. They're building here. I mean, that's all relatively straightforward. I mean, you can just notice little things. Specialism. You know, that's what I was just referring to. You can get to think that everyone can just specialize to the nth degree, and magically, it'll all just be coordinated. The ism part of the specialism. No, it's not going to magically coordinate. What it'll actually, like they're saying, without that overt coordinating individuals, because that's their job, the deeper everyone goes, the more everything fractures up and it all falls apart. That's the divide and conquer phenomenon. Right? It just can't, you know, if there's no glue, guess what? It's not held together. It's not complicated.
On a level of like the mother coordinates everything, but on a downstep level?
See, the more you go forward as civilization, the more there has to be people who are doing the job that the mother does sort of in the big picture, right? Mm-hmm. You can't, everyone can't just be in this total father mode. You know, that specialism is fatherism too, right? Where you just fixate on your absolute individualization relative to the father, you know, and then there's no society. Everything fractures and breaks apart into island universes, right? So, see, as more, the, you know, initially there's enough mother there naturally for the little bit of father that it, you know, it's kind of is self-coordinating. But the more personal everyone becomes, the more it doesn't just happen automatically that it's going to get coordinated. People have to start being aware of what you thought was magical isn't. It's called the mother. Things don't magically just coordinate. They're coordinated. And so some humans have to be coordinators too.
Like the mother.
Not just individuators. Okay? Yep. So again, you see why in this, you have to reveal both the father and the mother, or you can't be talking about the fundamentals of advancing civilization with just the father. Can't get there. Yep.
The problem for individuals in a coordinated system is the individual needs to submit.
Yes.
And unless you can submit wisely, you don't know who or what to submit to.
Yes. Yeah. We all know, see, and this all began 200,000 years ago, you know, with Kalagastya teaching us, you're not the boss of me. You know, that mentality. And, you know, us losing that education of cooperative subordination. Mm-hmm. Right? You are a part, and you must put yourself, see, in an active, personal, cooperative subordination to the whole. You're not the whole. Right? No matter how much you underline the ism at the that you've stuck at the end of your name, it's never going to be Chris-ism. Never, ever. Okay? You can bold it and underline it and circle it, and it still is not going to be Chris-ism. Okay? But you know, we all have this tendency to get into that mode because of the way things have been rolling for the last 200,000 years on this planet.
Okay. It is not enough to train men for work. In a complex society, there must also be provided efficient methods of place finding. Before training citizens in the highly specialized techniques of earning a living, they should be trained in one or more methods of commonplace labor, trades, or callings, which could be utilized when they were transiently unemployed in their specialized work. No civilization can survive the long time harboring of large classes of unemployment. Unemployed. In time, even the best of citizens will become distorted and demoralized by accepting support from the public treasury. Even private charity becomes pernicious when long extended to able-bodied citizens. Why can't people see that?
Well, you know, because it's not something we naturally have. They can write it in the book right there, in, you know, in absolutist black and white. You know, no civilization can survive. Yeah, period. So, you know, all those things are very obvious that how we are so struggling in this regard. You know, and but just, you know, making sure it's fully recognized. It's like, well, okay, yeah, I understand the public treasury thing, you know, the welfare system, but well, what about private charity? And it's like, even private charity. See, because again, remember why it's fundamentally pernicious, as they're saying there. Why is it fundamentally, you know, destructive, corrosive, whatever analogy you want to use? It's because more and more you have to be an individual that stands on your own 2 feet if you're going to be more and more personal. Your personality is absolutely unique. It doesn't wrap around you and that benefactor. No, it's just you. You know? So, you know, again, it comes to that, you know, you have to have these integrous individuals to get anywhere towards light and life. Let's see. I think we got everything else there. I think we got it. Keep going.
Such a highly specialized society will not take kindly to the ancient communal and feudal practices of olden peoples. True, many common services can be acceptably and profitably socialized, but highly trained and ultra-specialized human beings can best be managed by some technique of intelligent cooperation. Modernized coordination and fraternal regulation will be productive of longer-lived cooperation than will the older and more primitive methods of communism or dictatorial regulative institutions based on force.
Right, right. So, but of course, you know, if we don't take on that higher quality, you'll fall back to a feudal state, the interregnum, right, and the feudal state that goes with it. But, you know, obviously the immediate thing they're talking about is not that falling back kind of naturally into that state, but those who think we're going forward by either doing communism or, you know, centralized control, you know, that dictatorial regulative institution thing there, where you have a few lords and a whole bunch of serfs. You know, it's effectively feudalism, right? But, you know, you can convince yourself it isn't because, you know, everyone isn't grubbing around in the dirt with, you know, wooden pitchforks and stuff, right? Like back in the Middle Ages, right? But that's, you see a lot of people that are trying to move our society into a few intellectual elites who, because they're smarter than everyone else, have a divine right to rule, to be the lords over all the ignorant serfs. Yeah.
So the serfs are the people who are living out of their cars because they can't afford a place to live. And
right.
They're cleaning the houses and doing all the things that don't pay enough to have a place to live.
Right. The basic thing is there'll be people that, you know, are living in fancy gated estates, you know, with endless piles of money, no middle class, right? Importantly, see, you know, that lords and serfs, I mean, the fundamental thing that's missing there, see, there's no middle class, right? The middle class is what prevents that feudal system from, you know, playing out. And so it's a very ominous sign that, you know, especially in some areas of the country, the middle class is just evaporating. That means feudalism is just a hop, skip, and a jump away. Nothing else can exist when there's no middle class.
So it's a story of the haves and have-nots.
Yeah, right. It just goes back to the natural state. See, a middle class is not natural. That's the product of unnatural philosophic minds and the system that they manifest. Right. There wasn't a middle class for a million years, right? It's a very recent thing, right? It's a product of the unnatural functioning of human minds, right? And the more we've let go of that, you know, it's just going to naturally evaporate. So, yeah, when you... Well, I mean, people often hold up California as the poster child for this. I mean, you know, the middle class is just completely evaporating in California. And that's why California is evaporating, right, in quality. You know, there's going to be just those incredibly you know, wealthy tech giants and stuff, and then all of the serfs, you know, many of which they import now, you know, just, you know, see, it is to make sure that it gets the lords and serfs, so like import people that really kind of only have a serf mentality, and all the middle class goes, I don't feel comfortable here, and they move out. And it's just, yeah, it's rapidly moving to a feudal state.
Yeah, they bring in, they wanted to, now that Trump's around, it's better, but they wanted to bring all these people from to specialize in certain things for technology, for the Google and all those places and the IBMs and so forth. But anyway, and then their idea was to bring them in, give them low wages, throw out the middle class, throw out, who cares about the human people in America? Nobody cares about them. They're worthless. They're nothing. We bring all these people in. These people, then we go into socialism because nobody's going to have any jobs to work, and they're going to control everything. That's their whole...
I think I punched a button.
Okay.
Yeah, we can all get very animated about this when we see this happening all around us, right? But see, again, I mean, it's just, recognize what we're talking about here. I mean, this is highlighting, you know, can get us really focused on, yeah, look at that out there, look at that out there. But remember, the problem isn't really out there. The problem is really in here. All of this is, you know, can only be solved if each of us takes a hold of the only domain where we're sovereign. I'm not sovereign in the fields of California. I'm only sovereign, you know, in my inner life. And that's my part. That's how I can contribute. That's what they're trying to get us to recognize here, you know. Before you think about, you know, all, you know, rearranging molecules out there, see if you can rearrange the forms in your mind. That's step one. And if more of us have some measure of self-mastery, there's natural fruits of that that will manifest outward. And all these problems will reverse. But if I'm a hopeless blob of protoplasm, it doesn't matter if, you know, the Creator Son himself comes here and starts rearranging deck chairs. It's still the Titanic. And it's going down. Right? And he can't rearrange the forms in my mind. He has no ability to touch those forms. I'm sovereign there. He's completely impotent in the face of my free will. Okay, let's keep going here. Let's see, where were we? Did we get to 12? Let's see. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Dictatorial Regulative Institutions.
Okay, 12. Okay, yep, keep going. The willingness to cooperate. One of the great hindrances to the progress of human society is the conflict between the interests and welfare of the larger, more socialized human groups and of the smaller, contrary-minded, asocial associations of mankind, not to mention antisocially-minded single individuals.
All right, so you have, on the one hand, you have, all right, they're not antisocial, but they're asocial. Right? Have no interest in that. Outside of their little small group. And then they, not to mention an individual that can use their free will to go in an anti-mode. We already talked about this. Gene was bringing up a little bit the willingness to cooperate, right? Or you were bringing it up, right? I mean, that respect for leadership. You know, they're heading towards leadership. We're building up to that. Right? There has to be leaders, and there has to be a willingness to cooperate. You have to be willing to be led. No, Caligastia said we're all leaders and we can just exist in a confederacy of leadership. It's like, no, there is no such thing. Okay? You have to, if you know thyself, you start with that and you discover, oh, I'm a skin cell. Okay, I have a particular role. There'll be a small number of cells that are brain cells, okay? But I'm not one of them. But that doesn't mean I'm not important. Okay, I have a role to play. We're building towards that. But anyway,
No national civilization long endures unless its educational methods and religious ideals inspire a high type of intelligent patriotism and national devotion. Without this sort of intelligent patriotism and cultural solidarity, all nations tend to disintegrate as a result of provincial jealousies and local self-interest.
All right, so here's another biggie we often bring up. You know, we all know how intensely there's been efforts to demonize national devotion and patriotism. You know, very active agents against those, those anti-minded individuals. Let's pause for a second and notice how they word that. It doesn't say nationalism. It says national devotion. Most people think those are synonyms, but, you know, I try to bring this out all the time. No. That ism suffix is problematic. So there's that. Nations, yes, but definitely when you're, way beyond tribes, not nationalism. Okay. But nations, yes, and national devotion, yes, even. Okay, now, the ism part of why is the ism part of patriotism okay? What's a patriot, etymologically, literally? The root there that's P-A-T, okay, that's father. Right? You have the founding fathers. I mean, a patriot is a son of the founding fathers. Right? And there's the spirit of that of those founding fathers, right, is appropriate. It's they're the ideals, right, and it's why ism is valid in idealism. Right, you can apply zeal to an ideal, not to an idea, but you can apply it to an ideal. Sons of fathers is an ideal. Now, you aren't literally the sons of the founding fathers. It's an ideal that you're going to live as, embodying the spiritual motives of the founding fathers, a spiritual son of those founding fathers. Okay, patriotism.
Especially intelligent.
Right, especially intelligent patriotism. Right, it obviously needs to be more and more intelligent as the society advances. Okay. But, there's just intense demonization of patriotism and nations or anything that smacks of national devotion.
Devotion strikes me as this religious word.
Right. It's a vow. I take a vow. I pledge allegiance to the United States. Right. Devotion. Okay.
The maintenance of worldwide civilization is dependent on human beings learning how to live together in peace and fraternity. Without effective coordination, industrial civilization is jeopardized by the dangers of ultra-specialization, monotony, narrowness, and the tendency to breed distrust and jealousy.
Okay, so they come back again. Like I said, these start to get more and more synthesized. Notice as we go forward, more and more each of them kind of talks about many of them at the same time. They aren't so part-wise individuated like they were in the first part of the list here. But giving you some specifics about, burrowing into ultra-specialization, right? You just become, a cog in a machine, the monotony of it, the narrowness of it. But you still are trying to maintain some self-respect. And so it just, you start to, this tendency to breed distrust and jealousy. And what, I've only been in this village. And so I know I hate those people on the other side of the hill in that other village, a mile away. Right, you get burrowed into these little niches. Yeah. So like I said, it's the divide and conquer thing. It just breaks, it naturally breaks apart.
Yeah. That list of things that are the material comfort things, you know, greed,
Right.
Is jealousy is not one of
them. No.
And they mentioned it in the paragraph before, and they mentioned it again, and it's like, and also besides that, that's not a natural thing. That's an inculcated.
Yes, it's inculcated by the culture, yes.
The distrust part, I remember in the book it says something about that it's really harmful to teach suspicion or distrust, and I see so much of what's happening that's destructive right now is based in this suspicious distrust kind of thing, and also jealousy.
Yeah, I mean, the thou shalt not covet, you know, all the ideas of, you know, the drive redistribution of wealth,
yeah.
You know, it's like, what happened to thou shalt not covet, right? That guy has more money than I do. Some totalitarian government should redistribute it from him to me, you know? Yeah. But again, like you're saying, that suspicion, that you remember how those are the natural states. But see, you start out, you know, materially individuated and very suspicious of others and whatnot. And, you know, then society goes forward and higher things come into play that alleviate some of that. You start to work together in groups and stuff. And as you continue to go forward, you get into a new mode because as the individuals start to become more personal, they start to re-individuate. See, only now it's not a material individuation, it's a spiritual individuation. So they're even more individuated than they were by birth, by genetics and stuff. And so the problem reasserts itself where it's going to take even higher coordinating influences. You know, or you're just going to have, instead of just having mere suspicion, you now have, you know, new and improved suspicion, willful suspicion, see? Where there was no real personality and no will in play before, it was just a mindful phenomenon. And so these problems don't go away; they just get, you know, taken to a deeper and more difficult level as you go forward.
The seas are getting choppier.
Yeah. Okay. Let's keep going.
13. Effective and wise leadership in civilization. Very much depends on an enthusiastic and effective load-pulling spirit. 10 men are of little more value than one in lifting a great load unless they lift together, all at the same moment. In such teamwork, social cooperation is dependent on leadership. The cultural civilizations of the past and the present have been based upon the intelligent cooperation of the citizenry. With wise and progressive leaders, and until man evolves to higher levels, civilization will continue to be dependent on wise and vigorous leadership.
Okay, and when they say higher levels, they mean way higher. Okay, you know, that's way, way, way down the road. Okay, I mean, think about something that's parallel to the local universe settled in light and life, and so Michael can kind of just be out and about and doesn't need to be here as the leader. That kind of way down the road. Okay? But short of that, right, we've already brought this up, right? There has to be intelligent cooperation of the citizenry. Actually, I told you, and of course, of citizens. There's individual citizens with their integrity and their cooperative subordination to leadership, definitive leadership. Okay? If there isn't definitive leadership, it's all going to fall apart. And if there isn't definitive cooperation, it's all going to fall apart. You can't think in Lucifer's Confederacy terms. Yeah? Or you just distribute this leadership amongst all the individuals, right? And every mind is innately divine, and right, we all just magically, you know. No, there has to be a leader. Now, in that that federation instead of confederation mode, right? The leader is like that spiritual element above the parts below that everyone reaches up to with the faith grasp. Right, there has to be that leader that everyone is functioning in a coordinated fashion under for a long, 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 long time.
Okay. High civilizations are born of the sagacious correlation of material wealth, intellectual greatness, moral worth, social cleverness, and cosmic insight.
So again, the complexity of it all, the total system, like I've said so many times, and the material, the mindless, the spiritual, it's all really one system, no matter how much it seems otherwise. It has to be treated more and more as that total system, the more advanced you get as a civilization. You know, and of course, what's the foundation element there? Cosmic insight. Right? The individual's consecration to the harmony of the cosmos and the integrity of the cosmos. Okay, let's keep going.
14, social changes. Society is not a divine institution. It is a phenomenon of progressive evolution, and advancing civilization is always delayed when its leaders are slow in making those changes in the social organization which are essential to keeping pace with the scientific developments of the age. For all that, things must not be despised just because they are old. Neither should an idea be unconditionally embraced just because it is novel and new.
Yeah, there's a theme that we've often talked about, just reminding you how that's a key element in this scope of civilizational foundational elements. I don't think we need to really stress that too much. But obviously, the more there are new things that pop up, the more there has to be an ability to discriminate between the truth and falsehood of that new thing. When everything is, no one is very creative, and new things just don't happen very often, right? You don't need a lot of individual discriminative ability. Right? Someone long ago sorted it out, and you're just resting on those laurels. But when the more civilization advances, the more there's new things all over the place, and each individual has to be able to, no, that's false. Right? You have to discriminate yourself. You can't just live on established authorities of prior discrimination of truth and falsehood, supposedly. And so they're bringing that up, that whole bit about, you can't be mechanical about this. Oh, it's old, it's bad. It's new, it's good. And, don't even need to think about it. I could replace, the discrimination with a computer program.
Hey, there's a baby stuck in my plumbing.
Okay.
Man should be unafraid to experiment with the mechanisms of society. But always should these adventures in cultural adjustment be controlled by those who are fully conversant with the history of social evolution. And always should these innovators be counseled by the wisdom of those who have had practical experience in the domains of contemplated social or economic experiment. No great social or economic change should be attempted suddenly. Time is essential to all types of human adjustment, physical, social, or economic. Only moral and spiritual adjustments can be made on the spur of the moment, and even those require the passing of time for the full outworking of their material and social repercussions. The ideals of the race are the chief support and assurance during the critical times when civilization is in transit from one level to another.
Okay, so there's that italicized one. No great social or economic change should be attempted suddenly. So much for my protest signs. What do I want? Fill in the blank. When do we want it now? And like I bring up all the time. See, I bring that up all the time because it's literally italicized in the book, okay? The problem with those posters. And it doesn't matter what's in the blank because it says no, right? And then it says time is essential to all types of human adjustment. Not some, all. Right? And so it doesn't matter what's in the blank. The now part is always a problem. That's the impatience of Eve. Okay. Or Lucifer. Yep.
Where it says innovators should be counseled by the wisdom of those who have had practical experience in these domains. You know, because of writing, that doesn't have to be people that...
Right, that are alive today. Exactly.
Others or even people who have experienced this. And it reminded me of something I heard just today that Alexander Hamilton, during the winter of Valley Forge, spent much of his time reading Plutarch.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the difficulties and problems that he experienced way back
yeah.
couple 2,000 years
right. ago. If it isn't an individual who's alive that you know possesses some of this knowledge of the past, it has to be enshrined in books that can be read. Because one way or another, you know, someone who thinks they're an innovator has to be told, no, communism is not an innovation. That's the most primitive thing. That's where we started. Really? Yeah, really. You know, you can't come up with a more primitive thought. Wow, I thought it was like cutting edge.
New to me.
Yeah. Yeah, or anything else like that. Yeah, I think it would be really cutting edge if we set up a system where there's kind of these like leaders, and then there's all of the worker drones. Yeah, that would be a great new innovation. No, that's a thing called feudalism. What? Never heard of it. Yeah, I can tell. your excitement for it says everything.
You gotta make sure it's not Google or be.
Yeah,
probably not.
Believe me, true.
Now the other thing there, you know, notice it says only moral and spiritual adjustments can be made on the spur of the moment. You think, oh, see, no, my sign is valid because that's what's in my blank. It's a moral or spiritual thing. Do you know that those only exist in your inner life? Those are purely individual facts? What? Yeah. It doesn't say ethical, it says moral. Moral is about there's no other individuals in existence except you. It's you and your relationship to the cosmos. That's moral. Purely individual fact. And the spiritual, of course, is likewise. And you can even see that. And even these require the passing of time for the full outworking of their material and social repercussions, the fruits of those spiritual facts. Right? You can turn your inner life on a dime because you're sovereign there. Right? But the fruits of the spirit immediately go out in the domain where you're not sovereign. You know, and in the big picture, not even our master son is sovereign. Our sovereign, right, you know, is not sovereign. He's just universe sovereign. He's not grand universe sovereign. Right? So, yeah.
Okay, I think we might be able to finish.
I think we might.
Number 15, the prevention of transitional breakdown. Society is the offspring of age upon age of trial and error. It is what survived the selective adjustments and readjustments in the successive stages of mankind's age-long rise from animal to human levels of planetary status. The great danger to any civilization at any one moment is the threat of breakdown during the time of transition from the established methods of the past to those new and better but untried procedures of the future.
Right, those adolescent transitions... where there needs to be agents of conservation. Right? So it's like Chris just was joking about a little bit ago, babies don't get thrown out with bathwater. Right? Babies have to be conserved when bathwater is changed. Right? They have to carry forward into the future. Right? You know, conservation is oh so important. You know, and you know, when all you're about is progress, like if you're one of the progress angels, right, you have to have a checkmate that's keeping an eye on conservation, right? The religious guardians, right, to see to the conservation of that which, you know, is coming forward, that it continues forward and isn't lost in these transitions that the progress angels are fostering.
There's an awful lot of push to just throw everything away and not stand on the shoulders of.
Right. We all know, and we talk about this all the time, that you know, that's the big problem. You get some recognition of a higher ideal, and you go, oh, let's just institute that. Well, it doesn't fit into what we've got. Oh, we need to erase everything we have. No, like they're saying, I mean, society is the offspring of age upon age of trial and error. Like I said, it took a million years to get the first professors of the first university. Okay? That's a lot of trial and error. Okay? And you throw that out. Yeah.
So you're throwing out your foundation.
You're going to go, you just inescapably will fall back to the very beginnings of everything.
It seems like some of the problem is that there's too much information available and coming at people, and trying to sort through that and weigh it and differentiate and think about it makes your head spin. So you tend to want to just not think about anything and step out and just disengage.
Yeah, right.
It's
true. Right, and see, the professors are not supposed to be about information. They're not supposed to be about data, right? They're supposed to be about knowledge and wisdom, right? They're supposed to be about the framework. See, and the more information there is, the bigger the framework needs to be, right? And if you're not even fostering frameworks anymore, let alone bigger frameworks, right, we just are going to get overwhelmed because the information just keeps piling on, right? And all we have is the little thimble that we were given at age 6 by grace for a framework. We're completely overwhelmed with what we're given by grace, our encirclement in the Holy Spirit. We need to take delight in cultivating. Yeah. So, yeah, this is a philosophic emergency.
So we need a comprehensive cosmic framework.
Yes, we do. Yeah, because the fire hose of information is not going to, stop until the whole thing collapses, right? And we go back to the Stone Age. But okay, now it's the final little tidbit in these items here.
Leadership is vital to progress. Wisdom, insight, and foresight are indispensable to the endurance of nations. Civilization is never really jeopardized until able leadership begins to vanish, and the quantity of such wise leadership has never exceeded 1% of the population.
So there it is. See how it ends? It ends with leadership. That's the final bottom line. Your civilization will die without it. Leadership is vital, right? It's the vitality, the livingness of it. And there's your wisdom, insight, foresight, right? Instead of legacy, tradition, convention, right? The dynamic living trio of wisdom, insight, foresight, past, present, future. Those are indispensable to the endurance of nations. And it's never really jeopardized until able leadership begins to vanish. And then you're reminded of that, and it's never exceeded 1%. Well, wait a minute. Caligastia told us that the 99% are just as vital, and they should rule. And they should demonize the 1%. Right? We've literally seen this paragraph play out literally, talking about the 1%ers. That's literally been part of our society in recent years. The demonization of this foundational truth of this whole section. Right? If we can just get rid of those self-righteous foreign potentate one percenters. Okay, yeah, sure. You shouldn't allow a false assumption of, oh, I'm the 1%, right? Because I'm really smart. No, no. It needs to be more. It's not how brilliant you are. It's how ignorant you are. Like I say all the time, right? I mean, that 1% has to have cosmic consciousness. Okay, not just have raw horsepower of mind. Okay, there's a lot of tech giants that have a lot of raw horsepower. Okay, but wisdom and insight and foresight, no, not at all. Not even the most trivial stuff from Proverbs, for Pete's sake. Okay. All right, so. A 1% there must be. We need to. It needs to be quality. Okay, so then they give us a little epilogue here. Oh, you got one little thing?
I was just thinking on the 1% idea, and instead of demonizing it and being jealous and want to tear it apart,
right?
Be appreciative.
Yeah, I mean, right, we should, I mean, I this was Lucifer's problem, this tiny little group of three people on Uversa, what makes them think that they have the right to lead, right, see, that's shades of this, 1% demonization, see, thing, right? That's why I said, that's why I threw in the foreign potentates, illusion there, just to remind you how. See, that rebellion is against leadership. Right? The system of rebellion was against the foundational element of civilization, leadership. Okay, like I said, a little epilogue here.
And it was by these rungs on the evolutionary ladder, the civilization climbed to that place where those mighty influences could be initiated, which have culminated in the rapidly expanding culture of the 20th century. And only by adherence to these essentials can man hope to maintain his present-day civilizations while providing for their continued development and certain survival.
Hope is not dependent on facts. Yes, it is. Right? And only by adherence to these essentials can man hope, genuinely hope, true and false hope. Right? You have to have more than just hope. You have to figure out if it's true hope or false hope. Right. Okay, so like I said, see the precision that's needed for all of those details that they listed. It's only in all of that precision, that precise adherence, right, that there's genuine hope. Instead of vainly hoping for the future, right, it's true hope. It's not empty hope. It's not vain hope. Okay, so like I said, it's just, you see how it all kind of came back to that precision thing that I kicked us off with. All right, what's their final little statement here?
This is the gist of the long, long struggle of the peoples of Earth to establish civilization since the age of Adam. Present-day culture is the net result of this strenuous evolution. Before the discovery of printing, progress was relatively slow, since one generation could not so rapidly benefit from the achievements of his predecessors. But now, human society is plunging forward under the force of the accumulated momentum of all the ages through which civilization has struggled, sponsored by an archangel of Nebadon.
So you had that paragraph we just read before, which was see a little footnote to this section, and then there's a big paragraph break. You go, oh, this is not more than a footnote to this paper. This is a footnote to the whole block of papers that we just finished, the Adam and Eve block of papers. See? You see it right there, right? To establish civilization since the days of Adam, right? We've just ended a block of papers that began with, the literalness, the immediateness of Adam and Eve. So there we have it, and we now move in next time. We'll move into the block on marriage and family. So yes, we'll switch gears and sweep through history again, evolutionary history, with a focus on those particular elements, marriage and family.
In 2 weeks.
Yes. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.